Bhagavataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Pratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantadhami Bhagavad-gita Bhagavad-vaishinim.
Let's start on 51.
Buddhya Vishuddhaya Yuttaha Buddhya Vishuddhaya Buddhaha Trityatmanam Niyamyacha Shabdadin Vishayans Chaktva Shabdadin Vishayans Chaktva Raga Dvesha Vidasya Cha Raga Dvesha Vidasya Cha Vivektadeshi Lagvashi Vivektadeshi Vivektasevi Lagvashi Vivekta Sevi Lagvashi Yatavakaya Manasaha Yatavakaya Manasaha Jhana Yoga Paro Nityam Jhana Yoga Paro Nityam Vairagyam Samupashritaha Vairagyam Samupashritaha Ahankaram Balam Darpam Ahankaram balam dharakam kamam krodham parigraham kamam krodham parigraham vimuccha nirmamashantaha vimuccha nirmamashantaha brahma bhuyaya kalpate brahma bhuyaya kalpate These three verses are actually, they're a set, and they're addressing the person who now is ready for sannyasa, the person who is taking sannyasa, either as a vividisha sannyasi or a vidvat sannyasi. Really, there's three types of sannyasa: apat sannyasa, vividisha sannyasa, and vidvat sannyasa. A person on their deathbed often will take sannyasa, because when they take sannyasa, all of the papas are, by that ritual, are released from all of those papas. It's kind of, I think, in the Catholics take extreme unction, you know? There's a blessing, and so when, even though you may not be at all ready to live the life of a sannyasi, when you're about ready to die, you'll often take sannyasa to be resolved of all of the papa karmas.
Like
the sannyasa karma is, that particular ritual is a very, it's actually, for those who have shraddha in the Vedas and have kind of experienced the efficacy of some of these rituals, the sannyasa ritual is a very, very powerful ritual that really cleans out, it kind of wipes the slate clean, and it's almost as though starting a new birth. And so when a person is ailing and probably is not going to be able to live much longer, they'll often take sannyasa. It's called apat sannyasa. So Swamiji, I remember he's given apat sannyasa to several devotees and people like that. They have shraddha, and they don't have much longer to live, and so they want to take that final ashrama. You have to remember that in the whole kind of the Hindu culture, the Vedic culture, a person will naturally go through four ashramas. The first would be the brahmacharya, where they're a student till their studies are completed. From there they go to the grahastha. The grahastha is when you are married. From there they go to the vanaprastha. Then the couple will kind of live as brother and sister, living a spiritual life, kind of at the edge of the town. They'll say at the forest right at the edge of the town. And then they will, before they die in their elder years, they'll take sannyasa. Right. And so it's not an unusual thing for a person at some stage in their life, in their elder years, to take sannyasa. When we think of sannyasa, we're often thinking of either vidvat sannyasa or vividisha sannyasa, which is something that a person can take at any time. You can go right from brahmacharya, from the student years, to sannyasa, because that mumukshutvam is there, or because you have gained knowledge. So vividisha sannyasa means at any time in a person's life, when they become a mumukshu, one desiring liberation, they become a mumukshu, they may be ready to take vividisha sannyasa with the permission of their teacher, which means they would take the orange so that they could live their life with a desire, as a sannyasi, with a desire to gain knowledge. Vividisha, like mumuksha, means a desire to know. Right? So with a desire to gain self-knowledge, they take the sannyasa. Everything Krishna tells them, don't do that. You wait to take your vividisha sannyasa until that karma yoga is complete, because it's easier to gain antakarana shuddhi. But you can take the vividisha sannyasa at any point and live the life of a sannyasi, studying and contemplating and be living with the teacher in order to gain this knowledge. So the guru, the teacher, can give you sannyasa, vividisha sannyasa. You take sannyasa with a desire to know. The other type of sannyasa is vidvat sannyasa, for the person who does know, who does have knowledge. The one who does have knowledge, that sannyasa is given. It's just a confirmation of their knowledge, and that's the lifestyle that they choose to live. Right? For anybody who has knowledge, they already, just by the mere fact that you have knowledge, you're what we call a sattva-karma sannyasi. You don't have to wear orange. But a sattva-karma sannyasi is the end goal. That is the goal of the karma yogi, of the vividisha, and the vividisha sannyasi. Sattva-karma sannyasi is the one who recognizes that I do no karma at all. The only one that does no karma is the Atma. The only one that is completely free of karma is the self. Your body is doing karma even if you don't want it to. Your mind is always active. Your sense organs are active. All kinds of activity going on at all times. Right? Plus the fact that you have to eat and you have to drink and you have to go to bed and sleep. There's many, many things that you have to do, whether you're a sannyasi or a karma yogi. The sattva karma means all karma. Sannyasi, the one who has renounced all karma. The one who has renounced all karma is the one who has never done any karma ever at any time, which is your being. So the sannyasi or the karma yogi, the mumukshu, the knowledge, the mumukshu will become a sattva karma sannyasi when they gain jnana-nishtha, when they have clarity of knowledge, because yourself is a sattva karma sannyasi. It's just the removal of ignorance. So now, in these previous verses, Krishna really has been talking about karma yoga and all of the attitudes that are necessary to gain antakarana shuddhi that allows this knowledge to take place, which gives a mind that has enough shanti, you know, enough proper attitudes, enough shraddha. The raga dvesha are more or less have become mitya. The raga dveshas have become dagda bijas, bird seeds. So that person then becomes a sattva karma sannyasi, is ready to take sannyasa. He's either ready to take sannyasa as a vidisha sannyasa, or he is ready to take sannyasa as a vidvat sannyasa, sannyasi. Means his teacher is recognized, you know, and the sannyasa is given. That's kind of to finish that off within this tradition. So here, we did this verse 51. So keeping that in mind, what has come before, so we'll just quickly go over this verse. Buddhya vishuddhiya yuktaha. The person who is endowed, yuktaha, with a buddhi, which is vishuddhi. Vishuddhi, it's a buddhi that has clarity, it is pure. The raga dveshas are more or less eliminated, as it says in the second line. The one who has that jnana-nishtha, that commitment to knowledge, their mind has antakarana shuddhi, then for that person, having that that clarity of mind, having that vairagya, he says, dritya atmana niyamyacha. So having that antakarana shuddhi, And also being able to keep the body, mind, sense organs under your control, right? So that the body, mind, sense organs are disciplined by the buddhi. They're not running wild. They're not taking the buddhi for a ride. The buddhi is actually able to utilize them as instruments for the purpose of gaining self-knowledge, rather than having the buddhi be always overwhelmed by the manas. So the one who dhritya, by that clarity and by that resolve, by that viveka, it's clarity with viveka. Dhriti means kind of a resolve. The body, mind, sense organs are kept under their control. And that being so, then he says also, these are just, you know, first being endowed with that clear mind and dhikarana shuddhi, and being one who through viveka and resolve, having kept the mind, body, sense organs disciplined, niyamya, then shabdadin vishayans tektwa, then having, tektwa means renounced, having given up, shabdadin vishayan, all the sense objects, beginning with your set, the objects of sound, your sound, the five sense objects, that would be sound, anything that can be touched, anything that can be heard, anything that can be touched, anything that can be seen, anything that can be tasted, anything that can be smelled. All of these vishyas, giving them up means these are not the things that I'm pursuing. They're not what I'm interested in. Those have been given up by me. So having given up all of those things, and then not only that, having given them all up, because now sannyasa, this is for the sannyasi, if I've taken sannyasa, I'm no longer after sensory pursuits. That's not my mission. And I have the control of my sense organs and mind in order to pull my mind back from those type of pursuits, because I'm basically interested in shravana, manana, nididhyasana, kathana. Kathana means, you know, teaching, and also satsang. That's my life. Whatever, everything that I'm doing is really, as a sannyasi, is really centered on gaining jnana nishtha. So there's shravana, manana, nididhyasana, and then guru seva. If you're still living with the guru, there's guru seva, taking care of the guru, taking care of the ashram, there's guru seva. Katana means just speaking, talking, satsang. And then it also means teaching. These are in Panchadashi, you'll see these things listed like this. So that's the world of the sannyasi, not going after, you know, sense pursuits. But so when that's the world of the sannyasi, then what are you engaged in besides shravana, manana, nididhyasana, these things? Well, you have to eat, right? You have to get your food, you have to keep your body clean, you have to keep your little place clean. It's just the basic survival things. That's what you do. You keep your little place in order and you feed yourself the food that needs to be, that you need to continue on. But then he says, raga dvesha vyudasya. And even for these little things that are left for you, you can also have raga dvesha. Raga dvesha means likes and dislikes. Yeah. Like one that I can think, one I can think of that maybe you can relate to especially if you've been to India. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. It means that you continue to do shravana with your teacher until that nishtha, that clarity is there. But that's one of the things that you can have raga dvesha over that. You can be attached to your seat where you sit. We used to always be attached to our seats. Everybody loves their seat. They like to sit in exactly the same place. And that would be very upsetting when the seat would be, somebody would take the seat. There's an issue. Raga dvesha, my happiness depends on my having my seat. another issue that would come up is the fans. Some people really like the fans and they need the cooler coming down on them, and others don't want the fans because it's too much cooler coming down on them. So there's a raga dvesha, they're around the fan, but you know, the fan. Then there's raga dvesha's around the type of food that's being served, because we have to eat. But what if the the food is food. I mean, if it's wholesome, good food, then the use of the food is food. But then you could want a certain type of food and be disappointed when that type of food was not coming. Or at the ashram, if on Tuesdays and Saturdays, they give really white bread. Like, you know, like, what's that?
Wonder Bread.
Like Wonder Bread. It looks just like Wonder Bread. And so the Westerners love the Wonder Bread. You wouldn't think you'd love Wonder Bread, but there to have that bread is a really a big thing. And so what if the bread doesn't come on that Saturday? You've been waiting for the bread. So anyway, this is the point. This is the point. Even when you take sannyasa and you've given up all of these things, because you are single-pointed, really, you can still have raga dvesha. And you can still get upset, you know. You can get upset about your room, everything. Everything about your environment then can take on these raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes. Raga dvesha is much different than preferences. Preferences will be there your whole lifetime. But there's nothing wrong with a preference. What we mean by preference is, if I have it, that's great. That's my preference. If I don't, I'm fine. It doesn't matter. I mean, really, it doesn't matter. That's what we call dugdha bija. It's a burnt seed. Preferences are normal. It's not like a person just becomes flat, you know? Like everything is exactly the same. They don't have any preferences, any feelings, any special friendships, nothing. There's nothing. That's not true. Preferences are there, they remain, but they don't matter in terms of your well-being. They don't matter at all. So what he's saying is that even in this the world of the sannyasi, raga dveshas creep in. And so those raga dveshas are something which you notice and let go. Your mind, because you let go, because you have the clarity and alertness to recognize them, and that's just not the direction that you're going. It's not what I want. I want to be able to be with Ishwara. I want to be able to be with Ishwara as Ishwara is, and then respond to the world, but not out. Respond to the world, enjoy the world, participate in the world, and not have my world be, I was going to say sullied or tainted, I don't know what the right word is, but when the raga dvesha comes in, their pain comes in. Right? As soon as the raga dvesha comes in, then you want something. Raga dvesha means I want this so that I can be happy. The instant that raga or dvesha comes in, you're no longer free.
Yeah.
You're no longer free. But the good thing, the good news is, just like sticking your hand in fire burns, whenever a raga, and the true sense, not a preference, a raga comes up, it waves its hand at you. But immediately as it rises, it waves its hand at you with that tension or stress or pain or constriction. And so that just is calling to your attention that, this is something I would like to let go, so that I can just be present to what it is and do what is ever asked of me in that situation. So he's talking here. So this is the one who has that alertness. Right? It's not just giving up the sensory. You give up all of the sensory pursuits because that's not what you're interested in anymore. That's not your interest. But then you still have to live, and you still have to do this and this and this and this, and then you can, all those raga dveshas can kind of come into that small circle of life that you have. And it doesn't matter, that's fine, but you have to be you have to understand it, what it is, and practice letting that go. It's a practice, you know. Swamiji even talked in his commentary about the practice, we'll get to this in a minute, but the practice of even bodily movement, everything. Not that you have to walk around, you know, like this, but there's a certain level of consciousness about how you, what you say, what you think, what you do, how you behave. You know, it has the permission of your buddhi. It's sanctioned by your knowledge. And when your way of being goes outside of what you know to be true, that becomes a sadhana. It's just as a sannyasi, that sadhana becomes more and more subtle. I would say even as a karma yogi, the sadhana that you do becomes more and more subtle because you're alert and your mind is committed to really fully assimilating this knowledge. Okay. So let's go on to the next verse that we started. Vivek, om vivekta sevi lagu, oh we did already good. So vivekta sevi lagu ashi yata vak kaya manasaha jnana yoga paraha nityam vairagyam samupashritaha. So now he's going on. For somebody who has taken to sannyasa, then he says for those people, they are vivikta sevi. They desire to be in a quiet place where they can contemplate. Vivikta means without people. They will go to a place, a meditative place that is quiet. Remember, it's important here, we're not talking really karma yoga here. We're not staying in the world. We're talking about a sannyasa, actually taking that orange. So they become a vivikta sevi. They want to spend a life of shravana, manana, and nididhyasana, a lot of contemplation. They'd like to be in a quiet place and just be with themselves. So vivikta sevi. And being so, laguashi, they don't eat very much because they're not doing anything. They're not burning a lot of calories. And so they eat lightly. They eat lightly because they don't do much. So they're somebody that they enjoy being in a quiet place. Laguashi, they eat lightly. And yetava kaya manasaha. They're ones for whom the manas, the mind, is and the speech and the body are something which are yetaha, disciplined. Yetaha means they're under my control, like niyamya. It's in the same yetta. Niyat, niyam, comes from the same root yam, means to discipline, to control. All that means is that your mind, the manas is not controlling the buddhi is controlling the buddhi is controlling the manas. And so if your mind is having some problem, the buddhi can come to its aid. That's much different than the manas, the mind, the fluctuating emotions, overwhelming and taking over the buddhi, drying the buddhi. As the buddhi becomes strong in the light of this knowledge, then it knows how to handle the body, the body and speech and the mind. You know? It seems like that's how we all want to be anyway. We want to not be overwhelmed. We don't want to lose ourselves in the manas. We don't want to lose, like for instance, vak. Vak is our speech. When the manas or the unconscious has overwhelmed us with its anger or its hurts or rage, we'll say things that we wish we hadn't said. Because the buddhi is not there. The buddhi is overwhelmed. You know? And that manas is overwhelmed means the manas is completely just running wild. It's because the buddhi has not yet gained that type of strength. Or even skill. It's strength and skill. Knowing how to handle the mind in such a way that relaxes it and brings it home. Your mind can be wild, but if you know how to wild and hurt and angry and all kinds of unconscious things, but you, as you become skilled, you know what it needs to help it to relax, help it to come home. It's a skill. It's knowledge, it's knowledge and skill. So as we know how to handle the little ones or the angers or the upsets or our reactions, yetaha means we've learned how to do that, then we can always, almost instantaneously, if not instantaneously, bring the mind back to myself. Just bring the mind home. give it what it needs so that it wants to come home. What it wants, we can say in just a few simple words, it wants to feel loved. It wants to feel respected. It wants to feel that it is given the benefit of the doubt. You know? Like, say, imagine your parents, our parents, have all parents, poor parents, have always failed in one way or another. It's just how life is. And when Tamchandji will always joke that when you're young, you know, as you're young, your parents are just continually blamed. They did this wrong, and they did that wrong, and they did this wrong and that wrong. And then when you become a parent yourself, then you start becoming very sympathetic to your parents and totally understanding why they got into this problem and this problem and this problem. And in the end, as you become mature, then you honor your parents. So that's because you understand the problem and how difficult the whole thing is. So anyway, here, the manas, the problems of the mind, the mind wants to know, you know, that you respect it, that you respect those little ones, that you honor them, that you're pleased with them, that they don't do any wrong, really. If they're doing something wrong, you'll just help them because they're good little people. They're beautiful beings. They make a mistake, that's okay. We can work on that. But there's nothing wrong with you. You're a beautiful person. Every being needs that. You need to know that you're special. You're a special, beautiful person because the Atma is special. There's nothing more special than your being. Understanding how to be with the mind, you know, in that way to feel those things, to give it what it needs, the mind will come right home to you. You know, being conscious of the body, being conscious of your emotion, being conscious of what you say. It all starts with the mind, though. You need to be conscious of your speech. You need to have some relationship with your mind. But that bhaktapas, remember we talked about that bhaktapas? One of the strongest great sadhanas is doing manam. Manam means not talking at all. Because when you're not talking at all, then you can always, as the mistakes, as the problems start to come out your mouth, they're not allowed to come out, and so you get to see them. Otherwise, they just kind of unconsciously come out. But if you mount them, then as they try to come out, they're not allowed to come out, and so you see everything that comes out. So mount them is considered very, very powerful. But the speech should be satyam hitam priyam. That's what it is. What you say should be true, should be beneficial, and it should be pleasing. You know, unless you're a parent or teacher, they give some license to your parent and teacher, you know. Everybody else, you haven't really been given that permission to be mean or to be strict. You haven't been given that permission. And so you may think lots of things, you may want to say a lot of things, but you have that discipline to control what you actually let out into the world. You know, it should be true. It should be beneficial to the person. It should be pleasing. You know, things that are hurtful or mean or cruel are not really beneficial, even to you, even though you're letting off steam. You may think it's beneficial because I'm letting off all of that steam, but actually it's not, because you're hurt also by hurting another person. So that person, the sannyasi, yatavat kaya manasaha, he's the one who has all these things under control. And such a person is jnana yoga paraha, one whose commitment is to contemplation. Jnana means, the yoga means, you can take this two ways. Their yoga, their commitment, their life commitment is to meditation, jnana, contemplating on what they've gained at the time of teaching. Or you can say, jnana, they are committed to jnana and yoga, where yoga is all the antakarana shuddhi, the karma yoga, and the practice of being able to bring my mind to myself with pranayama and various things, to bring my mind into myself. And then jnana is then bringing to my mind such words as asangoham, or aham brahmasmi, or ishwaroham, having brought my mind back to my being, I then do dhyanam, nididhyasana, by bringing in phrases that my mind can contemplate on, can see the, contemplate on and see the truth of. Like if I say, asangoham, asangaha, I am asangaha, my being is not attached to anything. I could give a whole lecture on what that means, or a whole unfoldment on what asanga means. But in the end, if the pramana is being used, then when we say the word asanga, if I say asangoham, I am asangaha, my mind should see the truth of it. If I say aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, so much shravana and manana has been done that now when I say I am Brahman in dhyanam, in meditation, then my mind should actually recognize the fact, to recognize me as Brahman, see the truth of it. So the same as shantoham, I should recognize the absolute stillness of my being. So there's been so much pramana, so much teaching, shravana taking place to make me see this. Now I just need this phrase. Another is just om. Just if I were to say om dabhisena sir sannyasi, you shouldn't just say that particular mantra. Just om. But when we do the Mandukya Upanishad, you realize every time you say om, that what happens is that exactly what om is comes to your mind. So these words then are words that land on you, on the truth of your being. So that's the Jnana Yoga Padaha. The one, Swamiji will joke and say, the one who's just committed to being by themselves, not eating very much and everything's under control, what else are they going to do? You know, that's their lifestyle. They just spend their time doing jhanam. What else do they want to do? And then nityam means that always that's what they're doing, is contemplating. And then vairagyam, samupashritaha. And their whole mind actually is devoted to, sits in vairagya, that dispassion. Vairagya, when you're learning the viveka, vairagya, shamadhi, shatka, and mumukshutvam, when we first start learning vairagya, dispassion, as a mumukshu, it has a more negative connotation, can. Like, I have recognized that, because I have viveka, I have recognized that nothing in this world can give me the ananda or wholeness I'm seeking. So that's the vairagya. Okay. But that vairagya, once I gain knowledge, because it's something, converts into something positive. And the positive side of vairagya is, I don't need anything to be whole because I am happy in myself. And so it's not that none of you can make me happy, because everything in the world is limited. Right? It cannot give me that wholeness. It can only give me glimpses. That's not good enough. That's how we think of vairagya for the mumukshu. But for the jnani is, I am whole and complete. I don't need anything to become whole. And so they revel in that vairagya. Vairagya, in fact, is jnanam. Vairagya is nishta, is jnana nishta. To the degree that I have vairagya, I have jnana nishta. Because my mind is so full with my own self that I don't have this thought of, let me get this also. It's like in samsara, if you have a moment of joy or a moment of deep fullness, your mind doesn't want to interrupt that. You would like to hang on to that. And so what about when the mind discovers that it has all of its antakarna shuddhi, all of those, these kind of needs are taken care of. Raga dvesha is sublated, all of the externalization, if I want this to be happy, I want all of that, is no longer there. Then that mind naturally is doing what? It's no longer there. One of the reasons it's no longer there is because as this is being abandoned, this is being gained. Right? Knowledge is not just abandonment of samsara, it's the gain of the truth of samsara, the very, very source of ananda. So enjoying my ananda, then I revel in my freedom. Vairagya is freedom. It's a beautiful, beautiful freedom. It means it's fine for you to be as you are. It's fine for the world to be as it is. I'm happy to let Ishwara be as Ishwara is. That's an incredible freedom. You know? As soon as I start thinking, in order for me to be happy, Ishwar has to do this and this and this. In order for me to be happy, I have to get rid of this, have to gain this, have to gain that. Then I'm bound. I'm bound. I know I lose my freedom. If I can be happy, then if I can be whole in myself, then Ishwar can be as Ishwar is, and I can respond to it and engage in it. I can be so free. I can actually live in this world and be useful. Right? Because I can be in the world as the world is. I don't have to wait to get it just the way that I want to, so that then I can be in it. Right? It's a very, very different thing to be able to spend your time being present to what it is and being participating in the world in a helpful way, right? Because you're not dictating your terms so much. So let's do this next one. Ahankaram palam dharpam, ahankaram palam dharpam, kamam krodham parigraham, kamam krodham parigraham, vimuccha nirmama shantaha, vimuccha nirmama shantaha, brahma bhuyaya kalpate, brahma bhuyaya kalpate. Ahankaram balam darpam, kamam krodham parigraham, vimuccha nirmama shantaha, brahma bhuyaya kalpate. So here he says, vimuccha, having given up, first of all, ahankara, the ahankara. The ahankara, we could just say the ahankara is the I notion, but the I notion, identification with the body, the mind, sense organs, and also here in this context, it has this, we'll see as we go on, it has a sense of ego. It means, a sense of ego means in this situation I have these responsibilities, or I have to do this, or this is what I need to do, this is what needs to be done. Instead of recognizing I'm going to do this, it has a different flavor of this is what's being asked of me in the situation. You know, this situation is here, this is what Bhagavan has given me to do in this situation. It's not that I've created it. It's that this situation has been given to me. And so this body, mind, sense organs finds itself in this room. Wherever you are, you find yourself in that situation. Right? And in that situation, there are certain things expected of you. Certain responsibilities, certain duties. It has more to do with duties rather than rights. What is being asked of this of me in this situation? So that's what they mean by ahankara. Also, when that's the case, then balam, whatever power that you've been given, by power means you have certain capacities, you've been put in, find yourself in a situation of responsibility, or you find yourself in a moneyed situation, or you're a CEO, or you find yourself in situations where a lot of power is there. There's nothing in you that wants to wield that power. The power that is there is not viewed as your power. It's just simply viewed as the what's there in the situation to be done and what is your responsibility in that situation. It's a lot different than thinking of yourself as a powerful person and wielding your power, wielding your money. Say if you're very wealthy, you know, then there's all kinds of things that come along in the bhakti with that. Often the Buddha with that type of wealth, because there's a lot of power in wealth. And so how do you handle those vibhutis, those things that Bhagavan gave? Everyone has their vibhutis. Vibhutis means their glories, the things that they're strong. Everybody has those. You might not view them as vibhutis because in this particular era, only these things are viewed as vibhutis. But in another era, these things are viewed as vibhutis. But for whatever your vibhutis are, whatever your sort of called glories are, those aren't something that you bask in. They're just something that are there as part of your responsibility in a given situation. So that's balam. the Balm, we're giving all of these things up.
Okay.
Balm, the next one is Dharpam. Dharpam means if I have certain capacities that and certain strengths, certain powers. Dharpam means that I like to be acknowledged for them. So Amji talks about this, you know, like when you're a little child, especially 2, 3, 4, when they do something, then they look back at you, you know, and they look back at their mom or dad, and they want you, their parent, to say, look at what you did. Isn't that wonderful? What a good little boy you are. What a good little boy. That's normal. That's where we're really building up our self-esteem, and we really count on our parents to do that for us. It gives us strength inside. And if we've gotten a sufficient amount of that as we're growing up, we don't have that tendency, when we've done something great, to look around to see if anybody's there, to acknowledge it. Dharpam is where I need that type of acknowledgement for you to tell me, you know, how good that was. What a wonderful person you are. How extraordinary talent you have. What an amazing, you know. What if I need that? What if I'm looking for that? That shows a real immaturity. It's a weakness inside. That dharpam, something given up. Kamam, given up. Raga dvesha kama is given up because that's a raga. I don't want kama. Desires are not important to me. In fact, the Bahur Karma Yoga Buddhi, desire is not what my life is based on. I don't want to be a person whose well-being has to do with fulfilling a desire. That's no longer at all what I'm about. And if I'm not about kama, I'm not about krodha. Krodha means anger. There's nothing, no reason for me to get angry unless I need you and you and you and you to be acting a particular way. Or need things to be like this. That's kama. I need things to be like this so that I can be happy. If I'm like that, then when I don't get what I want, krodha naturally comes. Kama, anger. Kama and krodha go together. They're a team. Right? Krodha naturally arises when I'm not getting my way in terms of raga or dvesha. You know, I get upset. I get upset because things are not as I want them to be. But what if I've already given up kama? I don't really want kama. I don't mind preferences. But I've already decided, as a mumukshu, this is not the direction as a sannyasi. This is not what I'm feeding. You know the old Indian saying? You know, there's two wolves. Imagine inside of you there are two wolves. One wolf is very, very angry and jealous, you know, and vicious, rageful. And the other one is calm and peaceful and loving and giving. You know, you have both of these inside of you. One old Indian is teaching his student. Old American Indian is teaching his student. You've got both of these inside of you. So the student says, well, how do I get to choose the one I want? You know, how do I get to control these? You know, if I just want this one, the one who's loving and kind, and I don't want the one who's angry. And the old man says, it's all about which one you feed. Which one do you feed? Feed this one, not this one. Feed this one, or this one will die off. So say I don't feed my kama. I don't want that kama. When the kama comes, if I think that my ananda is happy on that, then that becomes a sadhana. Then I pull back because I don't want the kama. I don't want the krodha. I don't want the samsara. This is all just application of my knowledge to all of the tendencies, you know, like the habitual tendencies that are there from beginningless time, actually. So those things I'm just neutralizing because I just see them as unnecessary sources of pain. Then if the kama and krodha is not there, this parigraham also I can give up. Parigraham means grasping. Grasping anything externally or internally. I don't need to hang on to anything. My hands are open. I can let things come and go. Parigraham means I need to grasp and hang on to, so that freedom from that type of grasping is parigraham. Nirmama, that all leads to nirmama. Swamiji says this, nirmama means mind, mind, mind. Nirmama means giving up that sense of mind, even the sense of mind in terms of this body. So he'll do a long lecture on this. You think this body is yours? Well, who gave you this body? Who gave you my parent? The parents gave you this body. You know, parents gave you this body. Who employed you? Your employer has certain rights over you. Parents have certain rights over you. Family has certain rights over you. Your spouse has certain rights over you. Your children have certain rights over you. So which part of the body really is yours? Your body is part of Ishwara. Your body is here as part of Ishwara. And so let yourself be present to what needs to be done. You don't own this body. Bhagavan owns the body. If you find yourself in this situation or that situation, let yourself be in that situation and handle it. Shantaha means the one whose mind has shanti, is cheerful, has a cheerful disposition. With all of these, as all of these qualities mature based upon your knowledge, Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate, one becomes fit for becoming Brahman. By becoming Brahman, you already are Brahman. There's no becoming Brahman. But what happens is that the quality of your life, the quality of your mind, right, is just in harmony with who you are. So this jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, owns up your being. There's no conflict between the behavior of your body, mind, sense organs complex and you. So you're not becoming Brahman. You've always been Brahman. You will always be Brahman. That's who you are. But because of ajnanam and habitual ignorance, your behavior, you know, needs to have some time to own up your knowledge. So that's what they mean by this Brahma Bhutaya. When one becomes fit. Fit for being Brahman. Being fit for being Brahman. The upadhi, the maya upadhi, you know, is an exemplar of who you are. Is behaving like yourself. You're acting like yourself instead of acting like, you know, you've gone off. You know, even in samsara they say that. You're not acting like yourself. You're not acting like yourself. What's happened? You're not acting like yourself. You seem very upset or very down or something. You're not acting like you. While here it's, you're not acting like yourself. We're talking to somebody who really knows themselves. Right? It says that you're not acting like yourself. You're not acting like Brahman. You're not acting like the whole, complete, full being that you are. Right? So, in order to, kalpate means to deserve or to be fit for becoming Brahman. These things, in terms of the upadhi, have to come into place. It's not about you becoming Brahman, you are Brahman. But the maya upadhi, jiva upadhi, can gain certain attributes, certain ways of being that are in line with yourself, so that you start acting like yourself. I like that. We should be acting like ourselves, not like who we're not, especially when we know we're not that. Let's stop there. Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha gobrahmanebhyah shivamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prativi sasya shalini desho yamsho barahidah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santiramayaha, sarve padrani pashyantu, ma kaschid dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. I'm losing my voice.
Yeah, was it gruff or what was it?
I think it's from the tractor.
The tractor.
From it's what? From the tractor.
Oh, tractor.
The dust.
Oh, it is, isn't it? Yeah. Mine is really scratching from
here. Yeah. We have to wear those white things. I don't like them. They're so tight, you know.
Oh.
So I ordered some. I ordered some white hankies.
Did you?
I go tie it around because we're doing so much work outside and tracking and cleaning and everything, you know. So that dust, you don't notice it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
Well, it gets in your lungs.
Yeah. What?
Did you
ask me if I was
during
the chapter?
No, I'll teach her this time. I know she wants
to. Okay, good.
Well, you know, the people that work in the fields.
I'm going to give it to you this time because I have to stay off of it.
So
I have to share. I have to share the tractor. Fun. It's amazing. It's a great big old, like, 1970 tractor or something.
The people that work in the fields, they all wear handkerchiefs filled with their face.
You have to, or you're just breathing in that. You don't notice it really, but you are.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and all of this allergens and things. We're going to have a camp up there over July 4th weekend. I'm going to send out a little notice, but I'm just telling you. Mark it on your calendar.
Yes.
If you want to come.
Yeah. Which is July 4th.
It comes on Saturday, so Friday is going to be a day off. Mm-hmm. Or it's going to be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. These are CIS students will come too. It'll be fun. Yeah.
You were just talking about how anger comes from likes and dislikes, which makes sense, but I was curious, like, it seems like there's certain kinds of anger, like, at injustices that you'd see in the world that might be, like, a kind of a helpful kind of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Swamiji's talked about that, but then that should be an anger that you choose to use, not an anger that's using you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's like a conscious use of an anger that's there, that you decide to use, not an anger that has taken over you. I don't think the anger that takes over you is useful. Even if it's just a justified anger, it's overwhelmed you, and so then you don't have any control of what you're doing with that anger. It's actually controlling you. That's the thing, you know, if we divide, if you divide the buddhi and the manas, right, the buddhi is where there's clarity and knowledge. And the manas is where there's the fluctuating mind and also negative emotions. So you don't, the manas doesn't have any clarity. That's not what that's about. The buddhi has the clarity. But what about when your emotions, like your rage or your anger or even your desires, are so strong that they're like a tidal wave over the buddhi? So the buddhi now has no say. It's been kind of pushed to the side or pushed away. And so then in that case, that anger is not useful, you know. But you can feel anger and then make a decision to use that anger in order to make a point or something like that. That's a call on their part. That's much different. And that can be useful. So I'm just talked about that. Just
that sounds pretty tricky, though, because once you get into the field of anger, it usually wipes you out.
Well, that's because your buddhi hasn't developed any muscles. There comes a time when the anger can rise, but your buddhi is much stronger than the anger, or of the emotion, or of the hurt, or whatever it is. And then the buddhi knows how to be with that in a constructive way. Like, what about emotions like hurt or sadness or different kinds of painful reactions we can have? Do those reactions come and the buddhi is gone? Or as they come up, does the buddhi know how to be there in a helpful way with those emotions? Just like with a person. What about if a person is raging at you? Do you become overwhelmed by the rage, which would be easy to do? Or do you have the skill and the strength to be with that rage in a constructive way, or with that hurt or whatever? So it's inside and out, having the skill, you know, and the space, you know, the space between you and the emotion, that you can, there's some wiggle room there where you can be with it. But these things are not just automatic. You mature into these things, but also it's practice. Yeah,
so knowledge alone won't make it happen. I mean, you do have to...
I think it does make it happen very, very... It can make it happen very slowly, in the sense, as vairagya develops, you know, through your mumukshutvam, vairagya develops. Viveka develops, vairagya develops.
Yeah.
As vairagya develops for something that you have vairagya toward, you know, that thing is basically neutral, because you don't need it. So in that way, there's a natural growth of all of these qualities. But on the other side of it,
mm-hmm.
there's habitual behavior. Habitual behavior of how you have learned to be as an ajnani. What are the skills that you have developed as an ajnani to survive in the world? And sometimes the skills that you have learned and have picked up, maybe from your family and the people that you associated with, are really skills that are not to your advantage, really, once you gain knowledge. Like, they give me skills that make you a highly aggressive person, or a very egoistic type of person, or a very controlling person, a domineering person. All skills that are not conducive to anyone's happiness, including your own. They're just not conducive. But that's how you've learn to be, that's how you've been trained by your peers or by the value system. And so now all of those things have to kind of be dealt with consciously.
Oh.
You have to come into consciousness, just ways of reacting where they're almost the reactions come so quickly, the ways of responding some so quickly, that there's nobody there to stop it unless you make a decision to work on that particular way of being. You have to make a decision. And to make a decision to do that, you have to have a value to kind of see the erroneous ways of that behavior. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 16 and 17, they went, and part of 18, they went into such detail, verse after verse after verse, of asuric and rajasic ways of being that are not in your best interest, in detail, so that when we look at each of those, like rajasic, you know, rajasic ways of being, or if they call it asuras, the asuric ways of being, they went into such detail that you can see those qualities in yourself and see it as a bring it to consciousness in a very clear way, so that then when those types of behaviors come up, they're not any longer unconscious, that they can just get away with it, you know, so they just happen and nobody inside says, no, I don't think so. That's why they go into such detail. It's, they don't go into that detail because they want you to to develop those qualities. They go into the those details so that you can recognize them, as opposed to the sattvic qualities, which is what we really, really want. Because the sattvic qualities are shanti.
And this, these three verses are kind of like that. There's some things that, and it's, there's a,
yeah, because they're
they
not
up,
this,
they're
not,
reminders. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for the positive ones and those you want to go towards.
Yeah. There's a lot of, he gives up this and he's giving up that, you know.
And it's mostly just practice.
Consciousness. Their practice.
Consciousness.
Recognition. Yeah. You know, like Swamiji's book, I give it, I know all of you probably have this book, and I give it to all my students at school. Value of values. That's such, but that's what it is. You gain a value for these values because you understand how it's in, these values are in your best interest. And these other values are not in your best interest. That's consciousness. That's understanding. Because if you think that this way of behavior is in your best interest, then you just keep cultivating it. Even though you become more and more miserable, but still, you think it's in your best interest because maybe you're developing more power or you're developing more money, but then you're unhappy inside. So you just learn another way of being in the world. And it doesn't at all mean not being successful or not being wealthy or not being anything. It's just that the person who's having these things has a lot of peace and shanti. And other people like to be around that person also. Because they're not needing you to be different.
Joanna, you spoke about grasping. What, can you talk a little bit more of grasping?
Grasping means that I need things. I collect things. I'm a collector. I collect things.
Like I need my coffee in the morning. Is that grasping?
No.
It's like hoarding.
Money grab, it's also a Buddhist term. It has more to do.
Yeah, but I want to hear
it has more to do with, or hoarding is kind of a good word. It's where I need to hang on to things. I need to collect things. You know, I'm not free. Like sometimes I look at it like I like that anything that I have I can give away. Anything that I have, I can give away.
Wow, that's my grasp. That's what I wanted to think. I'll think about that.
Well, what I mean is, it's not that you're recklessly giving away for no reason.
No.
But in the proper, you know, circumstance, I'm free to give anything that I own away. Anything. Swamiji is completely like that. He can give anything away. I mean, it's fine. If there's some place to give it, somebody wants it, somebody needs it, then he'll just immediately give it. But I don't mean in a reckless way. It's not reckless. It's just freedom.
This practice, say, like, you're subject to fear, maybe, as a starter.
Yeah. Let me say one more thing about parigraha. I just thought of it. To break it down, the root, gra comes from gra. Gra means to grasp. It can be used even in the sense of understanding, but it's often used like with your hands to grasp a thing. Like if I used to say grahanam. Grahanam means grasping, or, you know, hanging on to something. Pati means all the way around. Everywhere you're grasping, grasp, grasp. You have a tendency to grasp. So giving up this parigraham, this grasping type of personality, parigraha, this non-grasping, so it's giving it up, that grasping. So another way of saying that, I like it, that it's not just the Buddhists, this is very, and just in India, that non-grasping, you know, and they say non-clinging, that's that parigraham, the giving up that parigraha. Non-clinging.
But then rather, also mentally.
Mentally,
grasping, right?
Absolutely. He goes both mentally and physically. Mentally, you can have a lot of that clinging also.
Now how would that look?
I think that is fear. you know, fear of not being able to be with what is. You're trying to hang on. Your mind is trying to hang on to something. What about being able to be with what is? That's how I see it.
Sometimes, you know, people like tell you, oh, just let it go, you know, let it go. And then sometimes, I mean, not saying to me so much, but just like generically, I've heard people say this sort of like as a criticism, oh, that person just isn't, you know, they won't give that up. You know, they're not ready to give that up kind of thing. And, you know, I always sort of had a problem with that kind of.
That might not be what they, Swamiji means here.
I'm not saying Swamiji says that. But I just think sometimes with this non-grasping, like, particularly maybe more in the Buddhist circle or something, it's kind of like that you shouldn't cling to certain things, and then that can be used sort of like you shouldn't cling to these past emotions or something like that. But I think...
Maybe,
you know, it's almost
thing,
like if you
have
a choice. I don't think you always have a choice.
No, but see, something like that, there's a problem. Just the way you said that is the problem.
Uh-huh.
Like if somebody says to you, don't cling to those past emotions, or you shouldn't cling to that, that actually means nothing.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I shouldn't.
Exactly.
You know, like, now what?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there has to be... a means, a way of not clinging.
Right.
You have to know what needs to be done in order to transform those emotions or those particular problems or whatever they are, and that lets them go. So you have to know what you're doing. You know?
Yeah.
And then you become free of those things. You know, you need to become free of them, but you don't become free of them by somebody just telling you you need to become free of them.
Yeah.
There's actually a way of being with those things to become free of them.
Because I think sometimes, at least, you know, in that sort of New Age spiritual culture or something, there's a lot of blaming that goes on, kind of as if you have a choice to let go of certain things. And I don't think you do. I mean,
it depends what you mean by... What you mean by letting go?
I think you said, like, you just, it's like, unless you know what to do, what are you going to do?
Yeah. But there's one thing about that I think in the Bhagavad Gita, I know I've said this many times, but I just love this verse so much, which right now I remember in English, but you have really three types of desires inside. Means those problems, things that are causing problems. The first kind is so easy, you can just, you know, blow it away like smoke.
Mm-hmm.
There's some desire, something that's hanging on inside that you don't want, you can easily just brush it away, it's nothing. Those are easy. There's another kind that is more like desire that comes, it's more like, to get rid of it, it's more like cleaning a mirror. And it's, you know, you have to actually rub it a little bit and do something. You can't just go, shh. You need some work to really process that and to become free of it, you know. There's another that's like a fetus in a womb. And that, those ones, those hurts, or those subtle ragged voices, those hurts or problems, those can take a long time, you know. They don't just go away. They take their own time. You know, you have to outgrow them. Time has to heal them. A lot of time has to heal them. Plus knowing how to be with them in a way that is transformative. But it's not an overnight fix. It's a fix that can take years, actually.
Well, this is where the practice comes in, what you were talking about.
The practice and knowledge. Knowledge, you know, it's the practice with a lot of understanding behind that practice and a lot of ways of being, learning how to do that. Like with Swamiji and what we did, there's so many guided meditations and ways you learn how to be with those wounds inside. And some wounds are real wounds, and it's not pretend at all. And then even when they are more or less healed, there's still a scar. You still have a scar when you have deep wounds. When they heal, but they leave a scar. You know, so that scar could be a nice, cleanly healed scar, but it is still a scar. It's not like that never happened. It's not like that you forget. The things that are like smoke, probably don't even remember. You know, they don't stick. And even the ones that take some scrubbing, they don't stick much. After some time, you just totally forget it. They're not part of your life. There are some hurts that are not like that. They are part of your life for your whole life. And they're going to be, you know. But they're also scars instead of pussy open, you know, wounds. They are part of your character. They're part of who you are. You know, they're sensitivities inside around those things. But those sensitivities are no longer open wounds, and they also become, in psychology we talk about this, they also become, you know, roads of empathy that you have toward other people's pain and other people's suffering. You know? And imagine a therapist who had never had any suffering. I don't know. It'd be hard to kind of imagine the depth of empathy there. Mm-hmm. You know? They don't have to have the same exact suffering that you have had, but at least, you know, they know about hurt and pain and all of the things that human beings go through that are hard.
So, rather, the grasping fear could be also fetus stuff.
Yeah. That's right. That takes, especially, you know, the real heavy-duty childhood traumas, which, you know, many of us have had. You know, you probably remember, I don't know, sometimes, I don't know how it is for other people, but some of us remember like two or three major events, you know, in our little young life. And actually there were probably many, this is psychologically what they say, you might remember two or three major, really traumatic events in your life. But those could be the three events which all kinds of other events get filed into. You know what I mean? But these three events are so you really, really remember, and maybe it has taken many, many years for the real pain and trauma of those events to dissipate to a place where you no longer feel, kind of controlled by them in some way. Some things are not overnighters. But you can definitely, especially with knowledge, you can definitely diffuse them over time. I think you have to be very compassionate with your own psyche and with the psyche of other people also. And not just assume that some problems should be overnight fixes, or some people will say, you know, oh my gosh, are you still working on that? And you have to say, yeah, I am.
And you shouldn't be ashamed of that then, because that's how it plays out, huh?
That's how it plays out. But then also we get the help that we need to work on those things.
Mm-hmm. So the knowledge really gives us this stability and becomes an in the front then to go through all of that.
I think so.
Because without it, it would be very, very hairy.
With the self and the skills, psychological skills, you know, to be with those traumas. It's really, really a wonderful thing. And you can also have these kind of limitations or whatever you want to call them and be very clear in your knowledge, but then you just know how to baby these, caretake these problems. You know how to do that.
That one term,
Near mama.
Near mama. Does that include sometimes a lot? There's a certain kind of clinging or pride of one's problems. Like some people seem to, like, they spend a lot of time, you know, saying, I have this problem.
If they spend a lot, well, that could be, but Nirmama, that's really for a sannyasi who is recognizing everything as Ishwara. So it's, everything is handed over to Ishwara.
Okay.
And so it doesn't really, that term is not going to apply to samsaris.
Okay.
Because that handing over to Ishwara isn't even known, you know. Even this body, gets handed over. Everything gets handed over. You recognize it all as part of Ishwara.